Welcome to The Scrap Show, a production of Recycling Today. Covering the business of scrap metal recycling, we feature conversations about markets, technology, the industry's rich history, and the traditions and ways of doing business that stay reliably familiar. Listen in as guests from across the country and around the world, processors, traders, and industry allies, provide insights and observations. The Scrap Show, a conversation between friends in an industry with a rich history and a bright future.
Hello, welcome to The Scrap Show. This is a podcast produced by the Recycling Today Media Group. I'm Chris Voloshuk. I'm an associate editor at Recycling Today, and joining me on the show is Scott Newell, chairman and CEO of Newell Recycling Equipment, LLC, based in El Paso, Texas. Scott, thank you for being on the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Chris, for inviting me.
Absolutely. And so one thing I wanted to start with, and this is something you've said to me a couple of times, is, you know, the philosophy that whatever's good for the shredding industry is also good for us. And it's, you know, kind of a nice uplifting message, you know, kind of implies a shared purpose, I think. And I'm curious, you know, when did you develop that philosophy and why is that your mentality?
I'm glad you asked that question, because what happens is that, you know, I mean, my dad invented the machine, and then I've built the second machine with welding. I mean, I'm a welder and mechanic. And we started selling the machines, and we licensed Lindemann in Germany, who at that time, they were the largest scrap equipment manufacturers in the world. And we were small town scrap dealers. And then we eventually had 5 shredding plants running, and then we started selling shredders, and then other people started copying us. And then I started getting people saying to me, Scott, why do you make all these speeches? I mean, I've made more than 100 presentations, and they said, you're telling your competitors everything, that all the secrets. And I go, well, we have more than half of the world business, more than half of all the shredders in the world. Maybe today there's, I think, 1,442 or something like that, according to the BIR. And way, way more than half of them were either built or licensed by us, and all the rest look like our machines. So I tell my engineers and I tell my salespeople, well, look, anything that's good for the shredding industry is good for us. And because if we're seen as the innovators and the ones who are leading, then we get some prestige out of that. We get some credibility out of that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people come to me and say, oh, I can buy your machine and I can buy it cheaper from somebody else. I go, oh, yeah, if you want to buy last year's machine, you can buy it from anybody. You want to buy next year's machine, you better buy it from us, because we operate these machines and we're constantly looking for improvements, and the evolutionary changes are fantastic. I mean, from one year to the next, there have always been some changes. Mm-hmm. And so I came to peace with myself about sharing information by saying, well, it's good for us anyway. And so my people started jokingly calling me Professor Newell, who think he has to tell everybody everything. So anyway, it's interesting you asked that question.
And, you know, can you tell me a little bit about the company, too? I know you've been in business for many, many years, and it started with your father, and the Newell name and shredding kind of go hand in hand. So can you talk about some of the development of the business over the years? And I know you're all over the world. So how can you speak to that?
It's been a very interesting life story, life history. Because we started as scrap dealers, and I started as a scrap dealer. I spent the first 7 years of my life running a shredding plant in Phoenix, Arizona. And it was kind of interesting how we got started, because we handled tin cans, and those tin cans were being sold to Proler and LA Byproducts, who shredded them, and they were used in the copper industry for leach precipitation process in mining of copper. And one day I was a scrap dealer, and I was in the Bluebird copper mine in Arizona, and I became friends with Mr. Al Stovall, who's the manager. He owned this mine. And a truckload of cans came in, and I said, "Al, whoa." Said, we buy cans in all of our five scrap yards, and we sell them to Proler, and he shreds them and sells them to you. Would you buy the cans from us if we shredded them?" And he said, "I don't know, Scott, because these, you know, there's kind of a monopoly. And if I buy anything from you, then they might not sell to me." He said, I'll tell you what, though. Look, I like you. If you could guarantee me 400 tons a month of shredded cans, I'll buy them from you." So I called my father, and I said, "Dad, I think I can sell some shredded cans. Can we shred them?" And he said, "Yeah, I think so." So he built a little machine, and we started shredding cans. And we supplied Al Stovall with his 400 tons. And then I started calling on the other small independent mines in Arizona. And pretty soon, we were selling more cans than we had. So we started saying, what else could we shred? And so we said, well, let's make a slightly bigger shred. Maybe we could shred a fender of a car.
Yeah.
And so we started doing it, bigger shredders. And eventually, Proler, I give them credit for that, did sell some shredded material to Armco Steel in Houston. And wow, we said, whoa, we can sell this to electric furnaces too. So then 1962, 63, we built a machine big enough to take a whole car. And from there, we started selling, and people started coming to us and asking us to make one for them. And so we did. Then we licensed Lindemann, and then I started traveling, and pretty soon we were selling all over the world. And we went through some growing stages, and in the family, you know, families always don't agree on everything. Mm-hmm. And so we reorganized a couple of times in there. And then when my father passed in the year 2000, I have to say, my father was not a good to great manager. He was he was a divide and conquer kind of a guy. And so my brother, sister, and I were all, we weren't encouraged to stay together. We, in fact, in his will, he left everything to different people. So we started sort of being in competition. So my son and I left the family business, that which was Newell Industries, and we went and created Newell Shredders. And so eventually the family couldn't really run that without us, because I had been the guy running it the whole time. Yeah. And and so they liquidated that company, and Newell Shredders then was immediately the leading company in the world on that. And then we reconciled in the family after that, and everybody said they were sorry, and we kept on going. But then I ran into a big problem with my foundry in 2015. Well, it was actually 2013. Came to my business one day and had a power bill. It was in July, and the power bill for June showed up, and it was crazy compared to how it'd been. And the one bill went from $35,000 a month to $85,000, and one bill went from $7,500 to $55,000.
Wow.
And so I immediately called Tech in El Paso. We had quasi-public utility. And the city and the county have a lot to say about the power rate. So they just said, well, we've decided that we're not going to have this special power rate anymore. And I said, well, but you can't just change that day to day. They said, oh, we published an article last February asking for hearings. Nobody showed up. Of course, it was printed in the fine print in some legal document somewhere. It was shocking. So I told the mayor, I said, Mayor Cook, I have 200 people actually working in my foundry in El Paso. And let's say if the size of the family is five, I mean, that's 1,000 people who make their living from a foundry here in El Paso. And you're getting ready to send a lot of jobs to China. They go, well, you know, we really can't help that. That's, you know, environmentally, we have to do this. Power rates have got to go up. You know, it was Obama's famous saying, power rates are necessarily going to have to skyrocket in order to control this. Well, they did. Well, they continue to, I fought it stupidly in retrospect. I fought it for a few years. I lost about $4 million because all of a sudden I wasn't competitive. I sold $10 million worth of castings from El Paso to China before this. So you can imagine my disappointment with that. But eventually the foundry just caused us to have to go through a liquidation. And we just couldn't be competitive. And so we started the shredder, you know, Newell Recycling Equipment. And so Newell Shredders was liquidated. And well, then eventually now we started manufacturing in China. And we started running the foundries in China, and we're selling castings all over the world made from a partner company in China. So our joint venture in China is called, it's with a company called China Resource Development Corporation, which is a state-owned company that has 50 scrapyards. And we started a partnership whereby we manufacture shredding equipment in China. And we've sold 70 machines there and have more than 50% of the installed capacity for shredding equipment in China. In fact, we have 20 machines of 10 or 11,000 horsepower each, that each one can produce 1 million tons in a year. I mean, each shredder can produce 1 million tons. I mean, it's a fantastic thought. Yeah. And so fortunately for me, we've been able to be very successful. You know, since 2015 is when we did that. And we've just been by far the leader in the world, you know, from that time. So we've had our ups and downs. I think we always tried to handle ourselves, you know, transparently. And I think that that allowed us to maintain relationship with people all over the world. So it's been a up and down journey, but right now we're on a very good we're in a good hot streak at the moment. So
it's good.
It's sometimes sad to think about those ups and downs, but I'm glad we made it to where we are.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm curious about how many installations do you have globally currently? What's the total up to?
Whoa, Chris, I don't know the answer to that question because shredders, we say, are like the family axe. You say, this axe has been in my family for, you know, three generations. It's had six handles and two different heads, but it's still the family axe. Well, shredders are like that. The replacement parts are replaceable. I mean, the wearing parts are replaceable. So we have some machines working in the world that are 40 years old, but then there are some shredders that are 5 years old that are outdated because of evolutionary changes. And so it's a little hard for me to tell you how many there are, but we've made more than 1,000 shredders. And yeah, it's pretty amazing, actually. I was recently in India, and there was a steel mill, a stainless steel mill that I visited. They said, like for you to look at our old shredder. I went, really? Okay. I walk up to that machine, and it was a Fuji Newell shredder. It was one we licensed in the 1990s in Japan. Okay. We sold 40 machines in Japan in the 1990s. And then all of a sudden, I find one of our used machines in India in a steel mill, and it was still working since the 1990s. And so you ask a question for which there is no real solid answer at the moment.
Okay, gotcha. And so, you know, when you've had some machines that have been in operation for so many years, I mean, that implies that, you know, the structure, you know, the main components are still, after all this time, I mean, you built the best mousetrap, right? So
You know, the idea that you've got equipment that's still out there after a long time, I mean, that really seems to speak highly to what you're able to produce.
Well, again, the wearing parts are all replaceable. And sure. And so if you keep it up and you change the parts that are worn out, then you can keep it running for a long time. I mean, I personally ran a 40-year-old machine here in El Paso it was still running. And then eventually we sold that plant to Sims Adams, and then they bought a new, what we call an 84 with 4,000 horsepower. And all of a sudden it's, you know, they've done a very good job with that plant. And we were concentrating more on the equipment side of things at that moment. And yeah, so they last a long time if you keep up with them. But the bigger challenge is keeping up with the technology, because evolutionarily, I mean, Chris, I'd say that in the last this year, I spent about 3-4 months going through Europe. And in Europe, I made a speech to the BDS, the German Scrap Federation. I said, I've looked at a lot of machines here, guys, and not one of them is working to world's best practice at the shredder. Now, downstream wise, they were really had developed, because the push in Europe was environmental, and it was for recycling a higher percentage of what you put into the shredder. And so their investments went into the separation equipment to take the waste material away and to recover the aluminum, copper, stainless, you know, metals, and then to work on the plastic. So, I mean, they've done a good job on the downstreams, but their shredders are just evolutionarily not the best. And so when we went in and looked at that, all of a sudden now we have a huge amount of interest from a huge amount of people. When we point out to them that, why do we shred? We shred to add value. So if we can add value in a more efficient way, then we accomplish our goal better. And so yeah, we're getting a lot of interest in the improvements, because gosh, machines today can be economical on 3,000 tons a month or on 100,000 tons a month, just depending on what it is. But you start looking at saving 50 cents a ton or something, it's a significant amount of value added. And there are a lot of ways to do that. Mm-hmm. And my son, Scott III, just gave another speech to the BIR, where he made that presentation about efficient operation and saving money on power and on replacement parts.
And so to that point, you know, when you've operated the equipment, you know it, you learn, you know, what are the best ways to operate it and what are some of the not so good ways. So what are kind of some of those best practices that you can elaborate on as far as, you know, getting the most efficient operation? And also what not to do.
I like that. I do make a lot of speeches. And for the last few years, I've been starting with those speeches a lot of times by saying, well, I've been doing this now for more than 60 years. And during that time, I've learned a lot of things to not do. I learned some things to do, but a lot of things to not do.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it's kind of interesting you said that. But the biggest thing for me is, if I take a chart and I show the theoretical capacity of shredders, and let's say I know that if it takes 14 kilowatts of hour to shred 1 ton of material to a density of 1.1 in a certain size machine, and then I know what the horsepower is, I can make a theoretical capacity for that. He said, if I use this machine at 100% capacity all day long, well, of course, nobody does that. I mean, we typically rate our machines at 50% or 60% of the theoretical capacity. So then that poses the question, why don't we run closer to theoretical capacity? Why? Well, the short answer is because the shredder is not being fed. If you could put the material inside of the shredder on a consistent basis, minute by minute, hour by hour, you would come closer to that theoretical capacity. So that's when we started looking at the computer controls for the shredder. And so now in the most modern machines, we have a computer controlling the speed of the feed rollers, the speed of the in-feed conveyor. And we're actually trying to drive the shredder motor to a closer to its thermal capacity, which is the real capacity of the motor. Until recently, I thought that the capacity of the motor was FLA, the full load amps. Well, the motor is actually designed to run at full load amps 100% of the time. It will dissipate the heat. But in a shredder motor, if you check the thermal capacity around the world, and I started putting thermal capacity meters on my machines for some time now, and I go into a machine and I see them working at 40% of thermal capacity, and I say, hey, guys, you realize you're only using 40% of your theoretical capacity? Because we designed the machine so that the only bottleneck to the plant is the horsepower on the main motor. So we want to be able to run, we want to be able to use the full amperage of that main motor, shredding at its theoretical full capacity. We want the downstream to handle it. We don't want that to be a problem. And so when we do that, then we measure the thermal capacity. And so now we have the computer saying to the machine, if we're less than 80% of the thermal capacity, we try to run past the full load amps. We try to drive higher than the full load amps and until the thermal capacity starts coming up to 80%, and then we reduce the target to full load amps. And by doing that, we have found, particularly in China, we have found that our shredders produce 30, 40, 50% more than the competitor machines with the same horsepower. It's just because we're using more of what we bought. And so we have more horsepower on our feeding systems than the typical competitor machines because we need to be able to turn faster. We need to be able to crush material and feed it into the machine faster. But that's one of the biggest issues that can add, you know, production to what you're doing. And you know, we talked about the slotted grates over the time, and yeah, that adds capacity also. I mean, there are a lot of little things that add capacity. And if you start thinking about, well, why are we shredding? We're shredding to add value. So then we need to do everything we can that increases that value in more tons per hour. The operator sitting there. I mean, it used to take in early machines, it took 1 man-hour per ton of processed material. Today, that's 1/10 of a man-hour per ton. So it is very, very significant improvement in reduction of cost for that. Mm-hmm. But if you think about tons per hour, the plant costs the same, the scale man costs the same, the office costs the same, the taxes on the property cost the same. I mean, there are so many fixed costs that when you start doing more tons per hour, you really do increase that value added.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you tour plants all over the world, you see these different installations. Is there anything in particular you wish more plants were doing as far as best practices go? I know you've spoken on some of that, but is there anything you wish maybe they'd get away from, or bad habits, or what do you see out there?
Chris, you're asking some very good questions here that are thought-provoking. I'll tell
you. I try.
You're doing a great job with that. I think that tons per hour is important. And that's one of the first things I look for when I look at a plant and I look at the thermal capacity and I find people satisfied to run with 40 or 50% usage of the machine. That bothers me. But then there's a bigger move in the world right now toward more density to create the shredded scrap with more density. It has a higher value. And a few years ago, we did a presentation called Value in Use, and it was based on actual data from a steel mill in Quito, Ecuador. And we summarized it by making a deal. It showed a picture of scrap going into the furnace, and we say, don't measure the cost of the scrap going into the furnace. And then we showed a picture of molten steel coming out of the furnace. We said, measure the cost of the scrap going into the ladle. Because denser, cleaner scrap in the furnace melts faster. It has less slag. It has less shrinkage. It hurts the electrodes less. It hurts the lining of the furnace less. Altogether, we think that today it's $50, $60, $70, $80 a ton less cost to shred, I mean, to make new steel with shredded scrap than it is with the alternatives. And so you're seeing that in some of the premiums that are being paid for shredded scrap. I mean, in some markets, shredded scrap is $50 a ton over prime, the other prime grades. So the market is recognizing the value in use. And, you know, and I'm proud of that. So we have a paper on density, and there's five different ways to make higher density. And all of them are good, but one of them is better than the others. And so we kind of explain why that is. And so I think that's be useful if people wanted to have that information, we'd be happy to share it. That's another place where my engineers think that Professor Newell is being a little too liberal with telling everybody what to do. But anyway, that's a, one of the lessons we learned was don't try to, you ask for the do not try to make the higher density only by making the grates smaller. You will consume a lot more power and you'll increase a lot more wear. It'll cost a lot of money. You'll make higher density, but it's by far not the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. And then I think that the next movement, Chris, which is really important, is the recovery of non-ferrous metals from the what is called ASR, which is a misnomer because it's not only auto shredder residue, it's the residue from everything you shred. And typically, automobiles are 28 to 30% of what we typically shred. I mean, the rest of it is miscellaneous material, appliances, fence posts, and all other kinds of scrap metal, including a lot of what used to be considered number one steel. You know, with these new heavier shredders, we can shred that because the shredded scrap is a better product into furnaces. Which reminds me, and it's a little bit of a off the subject, but dense shredded scrap is being used in blast furnaces and in BOFs around the world. And that's a new use for scrap, and it's very, very effective. And we see a lot of that in China. In China, they used to put 11% of the BOF was scrap. And of course, they have sort of a top-down government over there. They just said, make it 20%. And so there, I mean, it basically was 90 million additional tons of scrap that were being used in blast furnaces, just that with that quick deal. So China has sort of led the way in our experience with pushing for higher density and learning how to do that. So it's been interesting.
Yeah. And so kind of speaking to some of the changes and innovations, I wanted to get to the grates because shameless plug, that was in the October edition of Recycling Today magazine. So you can learn more about it there. But I wanted to get into, kind of how the idea came about to design a new kind of grate, because as you'd said previously, they were working okay, but you found a better way to put them in and design them, you know, fewer pokers, higher throughput. Can you talk about, you know, the origination of that idea?
Yeah, that's one of your slap yourself on the top of the head things, say, how did I not see this for 60 years? I mean,
sure.
Really, it's kind of shocking. I actually was with George Adams yesterday and we were talking about that. And I was giving it that slap the head look because I said, George, we all ran these shredders for 60 years with the holes shaped the wrong way, you know, but it worked. And so just nobody ever just checked it. But what happened was, is that I had a steel mill in China wanting to go to higher density. And so I was thinking about all the different ways to do it. And so I started thinking about this slotted hole, putting it thinner in the direction that the hammer is passing, but having it wider. And then we did a quick calculation, and all of a sudden we found out that in the bottom basket of grates, the typical is around 24, 25% open area. And by putting the holes in that direction and making them wider, all of a sudden we had 35% open area. I mean, golly, that's 40%, you know, 50% more open area. It just can't help but be better. And so we put them in the SA recycling machine. I discussed it with George Adams, and he said, yeah, let's try it. And we put them in there, and he said, so, Scott, you need to patent this idea immediately. This is the best thing we've ever done.
Yeah.
But we joked about it a little bit and said, well, it's hard to patent, and everybody will eventually get there. So let's be the first ones, and let's get them moving. So it was really an aha moment for me, and I felt kind of stupid that we could have done it differently for such a long time. I mean, really, when you finally see it and you try it and it's just different, you go, wow, why didn't I know that before?
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned there's also a power savings involved too. You discover that in the process.
Yes, I mean, it's lower kilowatt hours for a ton of scrap at that density. It's better. And I think the reason for it is, and that's also covered in some of my density letters, is you just don't want to hit a piece that's already fragmented to the right size and density. If you keep hitting that piece, you don't gain anything. And you create wear. You use kilowatt hours of electricity, and you take grains of the manganese wearing parts go away. And so it's just better once it's ready to get it out of the machine. And that's why we do a lot of recycling on oversized pieces now. That's really the most efficient way to increase the density. Let's only shred the pieces that need it. And it's a big deal.
And so as we, you know, start to kind of wrap things up, tie it in a bow, you know, as we go forward, what are maybe some innovations coming to the shredding space that you're seeing? Is there any component kind of like the grates that might be up for maybe an upgrade, or what do you see out there that might be the next wave in shredding? What do you think?
Of course, that's the one I think about when I'm daydreaming, you know, all the time. And I go back, I look at my speeches, and I go, man, we made fantastic improvements this year. And somebody will say, well, what are you gonna do next year? I said, no, I think this is it. I mean, I think we've gotten everything. Then the next year I'm making the same speech again. And you've done this to me right now. You're asking me about things that I'm thinking about, you know. And where I'm looking to the future is more in more automated separations, but also in more in the plastic and in the waste stream things. I mean, for example, in some experiments I've been running of the ASR, remember, again, it's kind of a misnomer, but by use of some very aggressive air separations, we can create an aggregate product that's about 15% of that can be used to make concrete, I mean, to make cement and stuff. Well, right now people are paying, you know, $30, $40 a ton to tip that in America. In Europe, it's $200. I mean, it's a lot more. So there's a lot more things to recycle than just the metal. And if we can figure out how to do some of that, we can create some more. We used to call metal a byproduct, but now we call it a co-product because it has such value. Well, I'm thinking that we're going to get from the co-product to the byproduct, I mean, from the byproduct to the co-product stage on some of these other items. That's where I would be looking at the moment the most. The other thing is the computer controls are getting better and better. They're smarter. I mean, for example, we used to put the operator in a control room up on top of the machine where he could look down. Today that operator is in a control room setting anywhere on the plant. I mean, it can be setting anywhere. And in China, we have a lot of those plants where you can go to our conference room in Nantong, and you can call any shredder that we got there and tell them we want to look at what they're doing. And we can look at their computer from that spot and you can look all the trend lines and everything, and if you see something that's not in the trend where you think it should be, then you can coach them and give them some help. I mean, we recently started a machine in South Africa. I had sold four machines there in the 1990s, and we just sold one. It just started up. Very nice guy, nice company. And they had a few problems, and we're just looking at it on the computer screen and saying, well, go out and check this, check that. And I mean, it's a fantastic help to have this online computer work. It's just a different world we live in. Yeah. And we sold that machine by video conference. We never even went there, if you can imagine that.
Talk about making the world smaller, right? That's incredible.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, otherwise, if I'd have had a typical, I'd have an inquiry from this guy in South Africa, I'd say, okay, I can be there in a couple of weeks, you know, and I'd spend $10,000 flying there, and it'd take me 4 days, and, you know, instead, we book a video conference, and he has his engineers in the room, and we have our resources, and then 2 hours later, we've made the full presentation, you know, with documentation and everything. Yeah, okay, send me the contract. I mean, it's a different world. Yeah. Much different.
All right. Well, Scott, I appreciate you taking the time out and explaining things and letting us into your world a little bit.
Well, it's been a real pleasure for me. I'm just living the dream. I'm very happy. And I have to confess that the other day I was in China and in a steel mill, and I'm walk up to a machine that's doing 1 million tons a year. And I walk up to it and I look at the logo on the side and it said Newell. And I said, that's pretty good for a little kid from a small town in South Texas to have his name on a machine that's doing 1 million tons a year on the other side of the earth. I mean, I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah. It's kind of humbling in a way when you think about, you know, where it all started so many years ago, and now your name's everywhere.
Yeah, no, I'm humbled by that, but and also very proud of that. It's very satisfying to me. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I appreciate it.